So hello everybody. We're today with Sherry Hugh. I'm really thrilled to have you on the Insiders podcast. Hey.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So most people know you, I guess, for the past few years for being somebody who writes in Forbes, in Billboard, in Music Business Worldwide. You also have now your Water and Music initiative, which is a newsletter, a podcast, and we'll get into this. I've seen you at different conferences, at MeetEm. You've been doing panels and conferences, and you're starting to be, for a few years now, the leading voice in freelance journalism when it comes to the music industry. So I'm really excited to have you
Thank
on the
you.
show and and to kind of tell your story to everybody. The person behind
Yeah,
the
super excited to
words.
be here. Yeah. Thank you again.
I know you as a typical New Yorker, and I was wondering,
Really? Oh gosh.
And so I knew that was the best way to start. So can you just tell us a little bit about where you're from? What's your story? Who are you?
It's a great place to start. So I have lived in New York for most of my life, by the suburbs of New York. So I grew up in a county called Westchester County, specifically a town called Scarsdale in New York, which is very suburban. There's like kind of like spread out town. But I lived just like an hour away from New York City. So I did go into the city quite often.
Were your parents involved at all in words, journalism, the music industry, playing music?
No, so not in music, but both of them actually at some point studied journalism, but in a super different context. It was in Shanghai. So they both went to university in Shanghai and they got journalism degrees there. And I think then, as well as now, like the state of media in China is in a very interesting place right now in terms of like government control, things like that. So they studied like I guess within that context, but then my dad ended up being super into math as well. And the reason why he came to the US was because he got the opportunity to go to graduate school here. So he got his in the US. So he got his master's in statistics at Stanford. And then after that, he went to New York to start working just on Wall Street in finance. So, and then my mom came along with him.
I had no
So,
idea
yeah.
your dad was in stats as well. We'll get into it a little bit later, but you actually studied
Yeah, yeah.
statistics, which is very
Yeah, yeah,
surprising
yeah.
for most
So
people.
that I think I get from him, absolutely. And then no, but there's like very little music, like formal musical training. Both my parents really like music, but yeah, I would say it was only with me, and then I have two siblings as well, two sisters. It was only with us that music really started to like become part of the everyday experience.
Yeah, I read somewhere that you actually went to Juilliard and studied piano quite, I mean, going to Juilliard is already being in the 99 percentile, I guess. What is your relationship to music as a somebody who actually played? Did you start very early? Was it classically trained?
So start I exactly. So started super early. I started when I was five, I believe. And I, yeah, the only reason I started was because my older sister was also taking piano lessons, and I guess my mom was like, "Hey, Sherry, might as well start too." But I just like really loved it. I actually kept going with it. So I was like the only kid in the family who just like stayed with piano lessons. That ends up becoming for sure my main activity just outside of school. And in high school only, so from 9th grade to 12th grade, I did the Juilliard pre-college program. So they have, formally, it's just a weekend program. So Saturday, every Saturday, the pre-college students go in and they take private lessons. They take music theory, ear training, like chamber music, if they want like electives like composition or like conducting classes, all with, I think most of the professors, the teachers also teach in like the Juilliard, like the undergraduate and the graduate level. So it's like a really, really great first experience for people who are interested maybe in just going to conservatory full time. It definitely is like treated as a feeder in that sense. So yeah, I did that every Saturday. That was very much like most of my life outside of school, most of like my social life. Like on the weekends, I would be like going to Manhattan and like hanging out with people who are also like piano students there. That definitely defined my social life. And for a while, especially around like 10th or 11th grade, so this was like 2011, 2012, I was like pretty sure I wanted to go that route full time in terms of just going to conservatory for piano.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you, most people at 15, 16, if they have a passion, they kind of assume that's what they're going to do for the rest of their life, whatever that means at 15. Did you think you were going to play in big auditorium and basically be a pianist as a living?
So the experience that that convinced me that I was going to do this was 2 summers in a row in, I think this was 2011, 2012 as well. I took part in the summer program called the Aspen Music Festival in Aspen, Colorado, as a music festival and school. Just super picturesque location, just in the middle of tons of mountains and woods. And the experience for string players is that, like, you go and take lessons, but you're also part of an orchestra that performs for the public. It's like super high caliber. But for pianists, they're not part of any ensemble, so you just go and you like
You just
practice for
play a
like an
little.
hour. And then you get to like explore the city. So I really like that experience, and like that experience actually convinced me that I wanted to go to do piano full time. But actually, during senior year, I like brought up this idea to my private teacher. I was like, "Oh, I love my experience at Aspen, and I think I want to like audition for conservatories and do music full time." And immediately she was like, "Sherry, do not base your decision to do piano on this idyllic vision of like practicing piano. Like, that is not going to be your reality being a pianist." I was so surprised at like how like auto, like immediately realistic she was, because so I guess like I guess my personality, if she's like, "Oh yeah, that's awesome, you should totally go for it," she was, I think she like had a lot of she also had a lot of students who were like super academically driven, but also were super into piano. And I think she was in the mindset of like, if you have something else going for you aside from music, you don't have to give up music by any means, but this is probably the best time to pursue that academic, I guess, degree or passion or whatever. And then you can always go back to music. You can always keep performing. So she, it was like, I very clearly remember the day she kind of sat me down and gave me this lecture, like, "Sherry, here's the reality of being a classical musician." And I was like, "Wow, okay, that's good to know." I was kind of like sad in the moment, but I'm very glad that, yeah,
Yeah, I guess
that
it's
she's.
yeah, I guess she said like if you have a plan B, make that your plan A,
Yeah,
kind of. But it's the
right.
same with
Especially
sport.
for,
No, go ahead, go ahead.
no, it's especially for something like classical piano, where it's so competitive and it can feel very isolating, and it's just, it's just you on your own instrument. It's very, obviously, I mean, the whole field of classical music is competitive, but at least with strings, you maybe have the chance of getting into some ensemble, or just there are more paths to like what you do after graduation. Whereas in piano, the perception is that it's very limited and even more competitive.
And it's such a we'll get back to this in a little while, but it's such a different thing to do classical music and be a technician of essentially, and to try to have a pop career. A classically trained piano is literally trying to play a piece to the best of her or his ability, where it's not about, you know. I mean, now some of them actually have like Instagram and social media and stuff, but essentially, if you're going to an opera to listen to a well, to an opera, you're not looking at the stats of somebody or how that person dresses or portrays
Oh my
itself.
gosh.
It's a very, very elitist based on technical capability, and it could be a brutal. It's you work a lot just to get to the technical ability to be relevant. There's no luck factor, there's no buzz, there's no release radar, discoverically. It's a completely different world.
That is such a good point. And actually, I think about this a lot because, yeah, like the kind of the field that I focus on now, I've written a tiny bit about classical music, but it's definitely like considered on the fringes of, yeah, like pop music or kind of what music is like topping the charts right now. And in, so I took private lessons for like 14 years, 13, 14 years. So I spent a lot of time like learning the craft of, playing instruments. But that whole entire time, I realized I knew little to nothing about how like the actual music industry worked, because the culture of classical music is all you need to do is focus on technique and you're good and you're set, when obviously that's not true. And some people from Juilliard and from other conservatories have like spoken out about the need to prepare students but like more effectively for that reality. It's like you could practice and like win all these competitions, but that's just like one piece of the puzzle of succeeding in an industry that involves a lot of politics and does involve it, yeah, increasingly a lot of marketing chops as well.
Yeah, and marketing strategy for classical music could be like a 1 hour thing in itself. The people are trying things. The majors who have a huge market share in classics and jazz have actually had some classical success with artists who do things that are not just being the best technical. There's been some concept albums and people, taking composers and trying to create like a concept around it to have a project that be a bit more visible than just like come and listen to me playing the piano. But it's very on the fringe of like 99% of the marketing techniques, you just can't apply them to classical. And whatever works in classical, you just can't apply. I'm very interested to know. I was like reading your story a bit, and I saw after that you went and you did statistics at Harvard. So now I understand your dad was into math and doing statistics and so forth. At one point, do you go from a teacher in a lecture or a teacher in a one-on-one telling you whatever is your plan B, make that a plan A, and you're like, all right, and was the plan B at this point doing maths, and we're still not even to the journalism part. So how did you decide to try to go to, I don't know if you thought, let me try to go to a really good college like Stanford or Harvard, and you picked statistics, or did you want to do math and statistics and then you just ended up going over there? But it's very surprising from a music journalist to have done classical piano and then did statistics at Harvard. That's
Is like completely nonlinear.
no.
So my plan B, or like the other thing that I really like doing aside from music, was math for a long time. So I was in math team, like my school's math team in middle and high school, and that was my main, I guess, academic extracurricular, you would say, like aside from piano. So going into freshman year, I thought I wanted to major in math at Harvard, my alma mater, which is like theoretical math. And I actually had very little to no experience doing like actual theoretical math proofs, but I like went in being like, this sounds like an interesting class. I'll see what happens. And I mean, as with any like freshman year, that first year like just really informed like my social group, like who I hang out with, just how I think about the world. And it was also so intense because like I took this one theoretical math class that took, so it was like a weekly like assignment that you had to hand in, and each one took probably like 25 hours a week for me. So the average was like 15 to 20, but then I needed a lot of extra time because like it was my first time even like trying out like proofs of this caliber. And so in that level of intensity, your social group ends up like revolving around that. Like people just like hanging out at the library trying to figure out, how to do this problem. So but yeah, so I it was a really enjoyable experience, but then after like the first year and a half, I realized that I wasn't as into that kind of math to major in it. And this is, I don't know if this is unique to Harvard, but like Harvard's math department, the people who major in that department, they like think about math all the time. Like they're talking about math like over meals. They're just like always like thinking about like different research problems. So like they're really into it. It's very similar just like to a lot of people in music. Like music kind of, surrounds their lives. So I just happen to not feel as attached to that specific culture.
A bit less extreme
So
than just mixing
yeah.
it. Yeah, 110% of your day to day.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so like I love that experience, but then in declaring my major, I was like, okay, I'm pretty good at math. Math is interesting. Theoretical math is probably not what I want to go down. And the two majors at Harvard happen to be applied math and stats that are more applied and like more practical, I would say, than just theoretical math. So and then so the reason why I went with stats is also because I'm the type of person who just likes taking those random electives. Like I'm actually I was not the best at like completing all like the academic requirements in time in terms of like general education stuff. Like I was like taking the weirdest classes. So and stats was extremely flexible. Just like the field of stats in general, like you as long as you just take these like the required classes you have to take in the degree, it's like really not that much. So it allowed me to take a lot of music classes, a lot of other classes in other fields that I like otherwise wouldn't have been able to explore. So yeah, that's how I settled on that. And
just to link a little bit music with the stats, there's a lot of papers that they're talking about how maths and music are linked, and it's more theory of music, not the whole industry marketing part, but the theory like first and fourth and fifth and diminished and so forth. And there's two kind of case study. One is the Bach kind of thing. People study him a lot for math. And then there's obviously the giant steps from Coltrane, where there is diagrams that you can find online. Those things. did you think about that at all when you were entering stats? Did you try to link the two? Did you study music and try to find math patterns on it? Or was that not at all?
So this was initially my plan freshman year. So I wanted to do a double major in music and theoretical math and do some kind of paper that combined the two. Yeah, because I was one of the few people, I just remember in the Juilliard pre-college like years, who actually like really, really liked music theory. Like a lot of other of my friends were like, oh, it's like a class I have to take. But I was like, no, it's awesome. It like it adds to my appreciation for the art. It doesn't take away from it for me. So yeah, I was like super tuned into music theory early on. And then actually a lot of the terminology, once you get into like more modern music theory, like from the 20th and 21st centuries, draw from math terminology as well. They don't exactly refer to the same things, but it's like they use the same terms like set theory or like what happens if you like the in math the concept of like inverting some kind of like shape, for instance. Like there's exact same concept in music theory. Like so just on a base level, I already was noticing so many parallels that I wanted to explore more of. But then I think I realized actually that I enjoyed, I think by the second year, I actually wanted to keep the two separate. I was like, I don't know if I want to like spend all my time studying this intersection on a theoretical level. I want to like have my music performance on this side, have my academics on this side. I think I actually realized that I enjoyed compartmentalizing the two, at least on the creative front. I learned more.
A lot of artists like there's a lot of musicians and composers who at one point kind of work in the music industry, even as managers or something, and a lot of them will say kind of it doesn't kill the dream, but it's a bit too much. Like if you want to play art and you want to be in your piece and you want to be in the moment, every time you're touching a note on a key on the piano or pulling a string on a guitar, if you're thinking like, oh, that's a fourth, that's a diminished, that's the master math thing, that's an inverted, you end up kind of losing that young spirit that kind of is needed sometimes to create or to perform with emotion. Having too much academic knowledge can sometimes kill a bit the creativity. Is that something you were fearing or was it something else?
I think that's definitely part of it. And actually, so the first two music classes that I took in freshman year were both jazz related classes. So one was jazz theory and another one was jazz improv. And there was such a steep learning curve because also they like actually improvisation was part of the tradition of classical music if you go back to like the 1700s, 1800s. But now there was an improvisation class finally offered in like the second semester of my senior year in high school. And so it's just like classical music has a perception of being just a lot more rigid in that sense. Like you gotta follow everything on the page. Of course, you can like have some level of self-expression, but it's like following a predetermined set of rules. So in taking like a jazz,
respecting the original.
Exactly, respecting history. I was thinking it's funny you mentioned release radar because like that kind of is like the opposite of what a lot of classical music is, which is playing the same piece over and over again that was written like 200, 300 years ago. But yeah, so like the jazz world was like totally different and so jazz is actually a good example of how you can study all the theory, and it actually is super helpful just to study like patterns of how different artists improvise, but the only way you learn is by doing. And there definitely is a danger of like getting too academic with that act of just doing it. So I definitely did.
The That moment in Harvard is your segue to having your first experience in the music industry. And most people might think it started by writing, but it actually started with an internship at Interscope at the A&R department, which another thing I learned. I was like, what? She went to do that. So I actually read about that, but could you just tell everybody how you go from Harvard statistics, which is very East Coast for the people who don't know it, to going to do an internship at Interscope. And for those people who want to have an internship at Interscope, the way you got it was actually based on merit at Harvard. Could you just tell about a bit about that program within Harvard?
Yes. So it's just such a weird story to think back. So sophomore fall was when all students had to declare their majors as undergraduates. And so I declared a major in statistics. I actually realized that I had taken a bunch of theoretical math classes leading up to that, but not that many stats courses. So I was like, oh, I'm kind of behind. And I, for some reason, resolved at that moment, I was going to drop everything music related. I have to, focus on my quantitative classes, just focus on my major. But then I also read at the career offices that there was this winter program or winter study opportunity for people interested in entertainment. So Harvard has a really small but really tight-knit and I think really high-quality entertainment alumni association, and they organize this winter experience boot camp for undergraduates. It's only around 20 every year, and it's 3 weeks long, and the focus is actually on film, not really on music, but the first week they take the students to tour every major film studio, basically. So we went to Paramount, DreamWorks, Millennium Films, a bunch of boutique studios as well. And then we also visited all the major agencies. So CAA, WME, ETA, Paradigm. And there's one label, Interscope. So Interscope was the only label that the whole group visited. And I think it's still the only label in included in the tour. But I think the SVP of A&R at the time was Neil Jacobson, and he was super enthusiastic and really liked the program and was super welcoming to everyone. So I found out about this program, and after I'd resolved not to do anything music related, but I was it's over winter break. I'll see what happens. I'll just explore. I have nothing better to do. And then I did this experience. And then as part of the 3 weeks, you get placed into a shadowing / internship experience based on your interests. So it was me and one other person in the program who were super into music. And so we both ended up shadowing the A&R team at Interscope. And I learned two things. One, that A&Ring was very different from what I'd expected.
I was going to say, did you find what you expect? Yeah. Or did you expect anything in specific? How was it different than what you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, I think, in part because it only lasted 2 weeks, there's only so much that I think we could do. So a lot of what we were doing, and some of the things that we did at the time were things that I had expected the department would have already taken care of. So the first couple days, the only thing that me and the other student, what we did was go through this database that they had of hundreds of independent music blogs spanning tons of genres, electronic, hip hop, etc., and just make sure that all of them were still running. And it was just an Excel spreadsheet, so we had to visit every website, make sure it was updated, write some notes about the type of artist, and then go on to the next one. So it was very menial, but at the same time, it was super informative for someone like myself who just had no idea about what this lesson was who was writing these blogs. Also, sorry, I noticed that it's kind of dark on my end. Is it? How is the lighting on my end?
It went darker. I think 5 or 10 minutes ago.
Really?
Yeah, but I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yeah.
It looks like you're now in a cave.
Okay, let me turn on. Give me 1 second. Okay, I think this should be better. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I didn't realize the sun would be setting right now, but
Oh yeah, it's because of the sunset in New York, right? Yeah, I was thinking, why is this going very dark? But I didn't want to interrupt you.
No. Okay. Sorry, where were we?
Yeah, so you were
Yeah,
starting to
so
understand how
yeah, how this
dysfunctional
function worked, and maybe it was a timing thing, but like there weren't that many artists who I saw like walk into the department. I guess I expected it to actually be a lot more directly involved with the artist, at least as someone, even as someone just shadowing that, than it actually ended up being. But yeah, I mean, I learned a ton just about like how, for instance, like the big role of A&R is just connecting artists with each other and like helping artists find the right songwriters, producers, engineers, etc. So yeah, it was a good intro. I guess I learned that I guess I didn't want to do A&R specifically full time, but it was also going back to how I like spent so long studying music. This is like maybe like a familial thing, but my parents, like, I'm so grateful they supported like a music education for most of my life, but they also were kind of skeptical about the viability of like having a full-time performing career. So like when I first like suggested to them that I might go to conservatory, they're like, "Oh, are you sure? Like, do you want to explore other things?" And so there's always this voice in the back of my head, like, "Oh, music is not, it's not a good career path. Like, you're not gonna end up enjoying it." But everyone I like met at Interscope and just at the other music companies I ended up like seeing during my time there, like there are people actually making careers in LA in the music industry and like really enjoying it. And I guess just learning about the diversity of the opportunities available was super instructive for me. So after that experience, my mind totally flipped, and I'm like, if anything, I'm gonna like dive more into music than ever before and like really lean into this, because I just realized what was possible. It wasn't just like a limited set of opportunities.
Sure.
So,
Yeah, I would
yeah.
say most people would imagine a label to be a one person signing artists and then maybe one person calling all the media, like the two roles, like promotion and signing. But there's hundreds of people working at labels. There's A&Rs making records, there's A&R finding records, people just signing what's hot, but there's people actually spending their life in the studio with artists. There's people who promote the different types of media. There's people who schedule. There's marketers. There's people who do finance. I mean, a label can be, a couple of hundreds. I'm guessing IGA has more than 200 employees. Yeah, and when you get in the first experience, you actually realize it's a bunch of people with, strong expertise in their field who are passionate. And it's true. They're all making a living. It's not performing music, but they're all enjoying music, working with music, and making
And it's
it.
not it's not like glamorous, but it's not like they're starving either. Yeah.
No,
It's like it's full-time employees.
Was your was the second experience Ticketmaster? Were you already writing a little bit before Ticketmaster, or did you kind of do one after the other?
I was definitely writing before. So after that Interscope shadowing experience, I applied for and got into a more academic program at Harvard Business School. So they have a summer research program for undergraduates. It's like one of the few times they open up to undergrads, and it's the way the program is structured, there are like 15 to 20 projects determined ahead of time, and you have to like indicate your preferred projects. And that same year, there happened to be one about music and innovation, and I was like, "Oh, this sounds like right up my alley."
Good timing.
I'm like, "Yeah, it's like it's all about timing, like every part of the story." So, yeah, I was like, "Oh, this seems like it'd be right up my alley. I'm like just starting to get my footing and like understand the industry." So I got in, and that summer was basically how when I formulated my interest in music and tech specifically, because it was a really good mix of just on a macro level understanding what was going on in terms of the impact of like piracy and streaming on the recorded music industry at large, but then also like a ton of just interviewing one-on-one with tech founders and artists who are trying to grapple with this new economy. So like that was the first summer that I met Benji Rogers. You know Benji Rogers?
Yeah,
Yeah.
sure.
That was the first summer I like really learned about Patreon. That was the first summer I met people like do you know someone named Kiran Gandhi? Madam Gandhi? No? Okay.
No.
She's a really good electronic artist and drummer who also got her MBA from Harvard and graduated a couple of years ago. So just like meeting a lot of like really cool, like-minded people who are dedicating their lives essentially to building in this space. So I was like, wow, this, I like came out of that like program in that summer just with a ton of ideas in my head about where the industry could potentially go. And oh yeah, another thing. So that summer, I like a lot of the research that I did ended up being included in a case study on Bandpage, which is not active anymore, but
the company Bandpage that was acquired by YouTube.
By YouTube, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. They were powering the concert listings. They were like a iframe you could put on your Facebook page, on your website, and so forth.
So just after that summer, tons of ideas in my head, and then I just started like a WordPress blog for free. It was like totally informal, and I was just like writing bullet points.
Is that still online today?
It's password protected now, but it's technically still online. I think if you want to try going to sherryhewitt@wordpress.com, it's still there, but you need a password.
I need a password. All right. I'll email you the password.
There isn't anything like sensitive. It's just like very unstructured. So sure. It's like that. So after that summer, I tried to go more to Berklee College of Music in Boston, because they had a lot of interesting events on music and tech and innovation. So I would just go to one of those events, sit down, open my computer, take notes, and just like lay out the notes in bullet points. And that would be a blog post. It was like very rudimentary. But then occasionally I would also just add my own analysis on like what I thought about the latest music.
But that's already the seeds of music tech journalism and research.
Yeah,
and,
I think so. Yeah. And I should mention, I did have some writing experience writing for a couple of Harvard's student publications about the creative side of music. So I would like interview like students who were artists on campus about their creative process, or like if they're putting on a show, I would interview them like ahead of time as like promo. So I had some experience in music writing on that side, but like very little on the business side. Like I didn't really know what went into business or financial reporting. And so, yeah, all of that I basically learned on the job, or just like in writing this blog. And then, so, okay, finally getting to the point where I get like my very first like freelance writing gig. So so this is junior year, and this is when like all the companies come to recruit students on campus for like finance, consulting, tech, et cetera. I like got very jaded with that process specifically. So I was like, oh, I'm not going to go to any career fairs. But then one of my friends was like, oh, Sherry, there's this advertising and media career fair that you should totally go to. It's a lot more creative, a lot more chill. People seem a lot more open. It's not like super chaotic, everyone running around. So I was like, okay, sure, I'll go check that out. And I just happened to walk by the Forbes table. And the only reason why I stopped is that there's an issue with Katy Perry on the cover. I think it was their like Celebrity 100 cover.
Okay.
No, I know a little bit about Katy Perry. I'll see what happens. If I approach the person there, and the person there happened to be I guess my current editor at Forbes, so like the editor who like gave me my gig. So his name is Zach Greenberg. He's the senior editor of media and entertainment at Forbes. And he and I like immediately started having a really interesting conversation about just like music. He basically owns hip hop coverage at Forbes, I would say. He like started all the magazine's coverage of like Jay-Z, Dr. Dre, Diddy, et cetera. He's like written books on the topic too. So like we talk a lot about that. And then I mentioned I was interested in music and tech, and I'd done like this project with Harvard Business School, and he immediately was like, we need more music tech writers. Like, you should consider sending a sample and contributing if you're interested. And I was like very surprised, and also like didn't know what to say or do, because I knew like nothing about freelance writing. I knew like nothing about like the Forbes model. I was like a complete blank slate, but I was like, sure, I'll like email you some samples. Sure. Yeah. And my sample was my blog and this one column I'd written for like a student paper that had nothing to do with business, but was a music one, but I guess that worked.
And so I guess if you have an opportunity, that's a lesson for everybody, but first is push your luck because you did not want to go to the fair, and so you end up going. And
yeah,
then the second thing is if you have an opportunity that comes and you know you can't really do it, but you're not like, it's not like you're asking me to turn off a fire and I've never done this. Somebody who's asking you maybe to like write words for Forbes, you've never done that, but you know maybe you could do it. Say yes and figure it out after. Yeah. So you said yes and you sent something and it ended up working out. What did you publish that, or was that just a way for him to filter out if you were interested or not, interesting or not as a journalist?
I publish what do you mean?
Like the things that you sent him as a test, stuff from your blog or.
Oh no, so yeah, it was things that I had already published. So it was I guess like a couple posts from my blog and some column, an arts column that I'd written for the Harvard Crimson, where I just like interviewed a bunch of artists. So yeah, they were already published when I sent them to him. Yeah.
Do you think today, if something comes like this on your lap, like something that you've never done, now that you have a bit more experience, sometimes we say like the younger you are, the more crazy you are, and you can say yes to
Totally,
things.
yeah.
Would you say yes to the same type of challenge today? Would it be harder for you?
That's a really good question. Now I've like I guess now I know a lot more about freelance writing and like what to look out for and kind of what to avoid. So I'm definitely I think this is actually like a good place to get at where you don't have to feel pressure to say yes to everything. So I've definitely like said no to a bunch of things that not because they were too risky, but because they just like didn't fit what I was like looking to do at the time, or didn't fit like kind of what I specialize in. I don't know. So something that I'm thinking a lot about, this is like very fresh. I don't know if it'll go anywhere, but something like going more into audio. So like I have my own podcast that I just run by myself. Very scrappy. I just like record the interview on my laptop remotely, edit most of it myself. So it's like very lo-fi. But I feel like in order to grow it, I would like to get more experience producing for like a much better established podcast that like maybe reaches a much wider audience if they have like an actual infrastructure. Like, because I actually have known very little about what that infrastructure looks like. Like, what's the day-to-day like workflow if you have like multiple producers making a scripted podcast? Like that's something that I'd be interested in learning that I have very little like direct experience with. So yeah, that's one example of like maybe if something totally random comes out of way and I have the opportunity, then yes, I will do it. But yeah, I would say I've like been in the freelance writing world long enough where it's the thinking is very different. I guess now I have a lot more data, for lack of a better word, just like work off of. Like, oh, I've done this worked, this didn't work. Okay, now I know, instead of just being, totally blind.
It's a great way to learn. It's to leverage. You go in a huge company and I started as an intern at UMG, and you're just thrown into this place where you can make some mistakes. If I screwed up a label copy or I screwed up something on marketing, I was not going to kill the business. Universal was going to be fine. If every intern at UMG just screws up their day, everything is going to be fine. If you go to in a big media conglomerate and they have this podcast studios with this five studios, 20 producers, and it's fine if you have to re-record the thing a couple of times or if you lose their time a little bit, leveraging a big organization in order to learn is really a key in like beginning of your profession. I wish I had more budget, but I'm literally recording you on Skype as well, so I guess you and I have the same
That's all good.
podcast level. The
It's
same
basically the
podcast level.
same, yeah.
Yeah. I was reading your like about thing on your LinkedIn, and I actually wrote it here, and it said, "Do you know it by heart?" No. I'm on a mission. I'm
Oh,
on a
no.
mission to propel innovation in entertainment by informing its decision makers on what really matters, and by discovering and wielding insights where no one thinks to look. So, quick question: where do you think we should look today? Where do you think are the new thing? I mean, you've been writing about that for a few months, where you think the thing is going. But if you wanted to summarize, what are the interesting, exciting topics, and especially the ones that nobody's really looking at?
Yeah, so something that I care a lot about as a writer, or just like someone being in music, is one, obviously music is like super important, or I think it's important, but two, music is like one ultimately tiny part of everyday life and one tiny part of like culture in general, right? Like there's even if you just look at like dollars and cents, the size of the music industry is a fraction of the size of the gaming industry, for instance, or like the film industry, in most places where you look, and like certainly globally. So some of my favorite articles that I've written have looked at how music, and also a great thing about music is that it infiltrates these other areas of culture really easily. So like looking at how music infiltrates the gaming industry, like that's an especially hot topic like this year. How like the music and film worlds are collaborating in interesting ways. Music and health, that's like also a growing topic this year. So just
what
like
do you mean by music and health, like meditation, ambient sound,
yeah,
sleeping, laid back listening.
Yeah, so tons of meditation, tons of like active health, like fitness as well, like apps that adapt music to your running cadence or something. There are a lot of people building for that. So those are like definitely my favorite types of stories, like seeing how music bleeds into other areas of culture or everyday life in ways that maybe you didn't think about before, from like the industry perspective in terms of how you monetize music or grow the market of music, just like unconventional avenues, as opposed to like only focusing on the $9.99 streaming model. Yeah, so I care a lot about that. This is something that is gaining more traction, I think, in people's minds, but I'm thinking a lot about, so I would argue that in like 5 to 10 years time, people should no longer think of the Western music industry as a default, or even like now, like the Western music industry, like should not be considered the default. Like maybe it is dominating globally in terms of like market share or revenue, but there are like countries with literally billions more people around the world that are like really, I think, setting the new norms for business models, for like fandom, how fandom works. I think K-pop is a really interesting case study of that, in terms of how just like the crazy fandoms around like K-pop groups is, and the fact that these K-pop fans are located internationally, like truly internationally, it's infiltrating the way that like artists who would not associate themselves with K-pop think about marketing. I think like that is like, that change is happening very concretely now. So that's another place I would look, or that's what I'm thinking with that quote, in terms of looking, one, decentering what's happening in the US and Europe. Obviously it's important, but it's not the only possibility by any means, and kind of leaving your assumptions about what models work best at the door and just seeing what's happening elsewhere in the world. So I just finished a trip to India for around 2 weeks, and I'm really glad that
did you go to the big music conference? There's a
yes,
big,
yeah, all that. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad I went, because it reinforced a lot of what I just said in terms of one, just the way that things work in the Indian music industry, for better and for worse. It's just like a totally different model, and like the questions that they're asking are totally different from what people in like the US are asking about streaming, for instance. And it isn't just a matter of like copying and pasting. Like people are even saying like, oh, is there even like a market for a subscription here? Like maybe there isn't. And so like, what do we do about that? Like what other models can we experiment with? So yeah, those are the, in terms of what like excites me the most and what I like most enjoy looking into, those I would say be the two main ones. So kind of breaking down borders between different industries. So like seeing how music bleeds into other industries, and then also like treating all international markets, or treating select international markets, as like equal, rather than just, you know, saying like what happens in the US is like, is the standard for everywhere else in the world. I just think that isn't true. And there probably will be a point, I'm like waiting for the point where at least half of like the Billboard chart is from outside of like the US and the EU. Like I think that's just like bound to happen.
The Billboard one will come after the global Spotify charts, because the the Billboard is really like US-centric consumption, but
That's true.
already
That's
in
true.
the top 200 Spotify charts sometimes has 10, 15, 20 tracks that you're like, if you're in America, you probably wouldn't know those, except if you were listening to the chart on Spotify. And you're completely right. The record industry used to have this, and I used to be part of that in France. It would be non-US, non-UK. So if you were UK, US, it'd be like global priorities. Yeah. And then we would be the non-US, non-UK. But it would literally be some Indian artist or French artist and a guy from Colombia. And we would all be non-US, non-UK, where there's it's just completely different like ways of
so
working.
So different,
And today that has changed, especially the US becoming more Spanish, Latin America. Like there's so many songs that are blowing up in the US that are not in English. And so the framework, the thinking process has changed a lot. I actually thought, coming back to the first thing that you said, which is the music industry is a lot smaller than other entertainment industries, but music flows. I actually thought that Water and Music, your podcast, and we're going to segue to it in a second. I thought the name...
I like where this is going.
Yeah, but I thought the name was that music is like water and it's going everywhere. But actually, I did my research and I know that it's from a Quincy Jones interview that says you will only say it there. But I really thought that you said music is actually, and it is, it's a smaller industry than gaming or movies. But in gaming, there is music everywhere. And if you take off the music from the gaming, even if it's not original composition, it could be a laid back moods, ambient sound, but there is music everywhere. And in movies, it's the same. If you take off songs and music from movies, like all the Spielberg movies start with this crazy theme and stuff, like Star Wars, like there's so many themes and songs that are related to. And so I thought your thesis on the podcast was that music, while smaller, was in every bit of the culture. And that it was infiltrating that to do like a water thing. Music was infiltrating all of the entertainment sectors.
That's definitely part of the attitude that I think I'm going. So I took the name from this Quincy Jones interview, but then in thinking more about the name, I was like, there's so much overlap. So yeah, there's like music flows, like water. You have sound waves in music, like waves in water. So even like the waveform. there are lots of words that happen to exist in both worlds. So the
Quincy Jones interview, so for people who haven't read it, it's Quincy and Kendrick Lamar, I think.
Kendrick Lamar.
And so what are they saying about water music?
So yeah, Quincy, and actually I saw him live in New York, or he just like showed up to his concert live in New York, and he said the same thing. This was like earlier this year, so I was like, oh, this is actually a thing that he says. So towards the end, I think Kendrick was saying something about how, like, the importance of, like, always doing it for the culture, or, like, always paying homage to history, things like that. And then Quincy Jones says, yes, and the last two things to leave this world will be water and music. And I was like, I think I already had, a very informal newsletter at the time, but I was trying to come up with a name for it. And I was like, yes, that is
Amen.
Perfect.
Yeah,
that, like, yeah, exactly.
So for those people who don't know, Water and Music is it's an initiative more than a newsletter and a podcast. It's almost, I would say, a philosophy. And and the first time I saw, so again, for those, and we'll link to all of that, but you actually have a profile on Patreon and people can contribute to Water and Music. Mm-hmm. But Water and Music being you, they're essentially helping you being an independent journalist. And that philosophy struck me, and I thought it was very unique. Every media in the world, I mean, most media in the world are getting paid by advertisers, and some of them have tried to remove publicity and get direct contribution. But I had never heard, but maybe, again, I'm not reading every journalist in the world, but I had never heard of a journalist saying, actually, I write for 5, 6, 7 publication. I have this podcast. I have this newsletter. I want to do exclusive content and go in depth and stuff. And the only reason not to be biased is basically to get money for your words and not get money by people who want to put an ad space in your newsletter. Can you just talk about the thinking process? There's so many artists who are trying to have a Patreon page. And but what was the, because in journalism it's pretty rare. So what was the thinking process? And at one point did you actually said, all right, Sherry, like I'm going for it. I'm sending that newsletter to I don't know how many thousands of people. To be like, hey, you can contribute here. It must have been quite a long thinking process.
It was really long, yeah. And even I would say even a year ago, A little over a year ago, I was not thinking about this because I was last summer, I was like very fortunately making a full-time living off of just writing for like third-party publications like Billboard, Forbes, etc., which is great. And so I could have just continued doing that, and I do continue to write freelance for a bunch of places. But I also realized that actually, and so there are a lot of parallels between like freelance writing and freelance media and music in terms of like the issues. So one, it so under the dominant freelance writing model, unless you deliberately go out of your way to set up something like a Patreon or some other like competing site, there's no such thing as like direct to reader support. Or so like the term used to be like direct to fan, right? Like fans buying like a piece of merch or whatever that goes direct to artists,
Direct to
right?
journalism, yeah.
There we go. The direction, direct to journalists. There's like no concept of that. And because basically the model is just a flat fee per article. It's like a commission model. The publication is commissioning you to write this piece, which is great. But if you're a freelancer who's like trying to build an audience and figure out how much of that audience you really own versus like what you're just leaning on a publication to get access to, that gets like very tricky quickly. If you don't have that kind of platform, even if it's not paid, so like a newsletter already helps a ton with that in terms of seeing who will subscribe to you, and not to just like a publication that takes precedence over the individual name.
Sure, and also
So,
connecting the dots between I might read you in Forbes, I might read you in MBW, but I actually don't know that it's you.
exactly. Yes, and exactly. If you're something like a newsletter, yeah, it's like everything is centralized, and you it's like a way to keep up to date with that. Exactly. So there's that element of like I guess having more control over how you connect with readers and what that relationship is like. Two, this like varies widely from publication to publication, but some publications are like really rigid in terms of IP clauses, like in contracts. So like a lot of publications will say, so like the best case scenario is like the publication gets an exclusive license maybe for like half a year to a year to distribute this article or whatever. But then afterwards, you, the author, can do whatever you want. But there are other publications who very strictly are like, no, this is like a work for hire thing. We take all the rights, and we can like adapt it however we want. And I think like for my kind of writing, maybe it isn't there. The consequences aren't as dire, but like there are a ton of like individual articles that are being optioned for films now. So like if you do want to go down to that route in terms of like adapting your especially longer form work for film or other formats, those types of clauses can get really tricky. So again, it varies, but a great thing about having your own channel is that you don't have to have those conversations, and you just like you own all the work that you put in, and yeah, so you just have a lot more control. And it's like, I guess, yeah, at this point, it is a trade-off between getting to write for a big brand name, maybe, versus just like own, having your own channel. But yeah, I would say those are like the top two priorities in terms of just having something like direct to reader, direct to journalist, like having that channel. Oh, yeah, and then intellectual property, and then also just like frequency of payment. This is not unique to, this is like an issue in music and also in media, in terms of like a lot of places often take a really long time to get, like I've definitely had to wait like 3 to 4 months for a payment on an article that was published like several months back. And so like that you can't control. And so if as like a freelancer, you're trying to have some sense of recurring income, that can be very tricky too, to even just like plan out. So having something like a Patreon page, it is a definition of like regular because in my case it pays out every month, and that's like much easier to plan out. So yeah.
Did you before you clicked and you send that newsletter to everybody, like I'm there, join me. Did you what was maybe the last thing that you thought about? Were you scared about the perception? Did you ever think like this is how much I think I'm gonna generate a month? Did you have a ballpark? Did you, or were you just saying like, this is the DNA of how I want to project my work? I have no idea what's going to be the result, but I'm doing it for the philosophy. Or was it like, I actually think this financially makes sense also for me? How calculated was it, and how instinctive was
Yeah.
it?
I would say I made this is like a positive thing, a super underestimated calculation. So I like had so on Patreon you can set up specific goals to say like, oh, once I reach $300 a month. So for me in this case it was once I reach $300 a month, I can launch a podcast and I have like the funds to buy equipment and pay for hosting, all that stuff. For 600, I'll launch this new thing, 1,000, this new thing, et cetera. So that's a feature on every Patreon page. And so I set up 300 as the first goal, thinking that I wasn't going to reach that until like 2 months after launching. So I had like a very conservative, and there was like no logic to doing that. I was just like, oh, like, because also I struggled to find other journalists who are using Patreon effectively. Now I've met a couple others, not in music, but who are like essentially running full-time online publications on Patreon, which is really cool. But when I first started, I like had very little precedent. So I was like, oh, is this even is this even gonna work? I have no idea. So yeah, so my very conservative projection was getting $300 a month within 2 months. So I wasn't planning for it to like even be close to like a third of like a full-time income or anything like that.
Sure.
But then it grew super quickly. It definitely reached $300 a month within a month or even like a couple of weeks. So I was like, oh my God, does that mean I have to start a podcast now? And like my God, I was like, wow, this is so cool. But I have to like reset my entire schedule. And then which is great. And then it also made me realize like, oh, if I continue growing at this pace, this probably by next year it can get to a point where it makes up the majority of my income, which is crazy. Like I did not expect that at all when I first launched. So yeah, I would say it was more guided by philosophy than by any expectation of it
You
growing
did
as
not do a
fast. Yeah.
statistical model on the potential revenue.
No,
What
no, unfortunately not.
do you think is
Yeah.
what do you think is next for Warrior Music? I was putting in my notes like somehow I don't see Sherry being the typical
Oh,
journalist
yeah.
in 5, 6 years. Where do you think this is going for you? Are you gonna keep writing? Are you gonna try to push the Warrior Music further? Are you already planning something else that you want to share? What's next for you?
Yeah, so okay, so for Water Music specifically, something that has now like come up that this isn't like an issue, but it's definitely like a kind of like a fork in the road is that so if you think about like the newsletter, which is free, there are close to 5,000 people subscribing now, which is great. So it's like a lot of people, and it's like people from all kinds of backgrounds, from emerging artists who like have no idea like what's going on in the music industry, to people who've been in the industry for a couple of years, to like execs at record labels, like people who are like true veterans and like are the key decision makers. And you've really so far it's worked to serve the same articles and the same product to all those people, but I think after a certain point, it's more effective to like segment that audience, like the questions that like the up and coming artist is asking about how to run their career is so different from like what a digital strategy person at a major label is thinking about, right, in
Oh,
terms
yeah,
of the
and
data.
sending the same newsletter to 5,000 people, you might think, oh, I'm going to segment my. That's a great milestone, I guess. If you have to start segmenting your people, that's like, oh.
It's a great, yeah, but I'm not sure how to approach it, and
So
also I
you're
a
going to
lot of
build
stuff.
probably the best one of the best CRMs for music industry professionals. Who
Maybe.
works where, how much experience, level of knowledge, and like
Oh my gosh.
should they get the dumbed down tutorials how to something or how to understand basics, or are they getting the crazy thing that you have to know all that, you have to know it all to understand?
Yeah,
That's going to be
yeah.
a tricky one for you, because even like
Yeah.
Billboard and BW, like if you subscribe to their news, you're essentially getting getting all of the news. Have you thought about
Right.
this?
I know, I've totally thought about it, and I so just to go with that example again, so like thinking about like the major label exec versus the emerging artist. So one piece of feedback that I've heard from a lot of people is that the writing that I'm doing is basically this similar to what a lot of consultants already do. They just don't happen to publish anything in terms of like laying out what's happening in the market and just like what's happening in the world of music and health right now. This is actually like an upcoming article that I want to write in terms of like what are all the startups, how would you categorize them? Like that is a very that's like very much like market research rather than a news like a straight reported news piece. And like the pricing structure around that could be different. I know like companies definitely pay more for like to get access to content from specifically analytics firms that are not
Sure.
news publications, right? So it's just like the pricing model is totally different there, as opposed to like an emerging artist who like probably does not have that amount of money to invest in like that same material. Isn't asking the same question anyway, so it's almost like B2B versus B2C. Maybe it's a way to frame it. Yeah, to use that terminology. So yeah, I mean I haven't answered the question yet, but that's something I'm thinking a lot about in terms of one, how would I be able to set aside time to satisfy both, or like is that even how I should go about doing it, or would that just like lead to burnout very quickly, and should I just focus on one? Because right now it's I've very fortunately managed to reach people in both areas. And maybe that is like actually the selling point of
Maybe the
oh
young
I've
aspiring
yeah.
artist is really enjoying reading more advanced stuff, and that's
Yeah,
why
yeah,
he's
yeah.
decided to go to, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So
Yeah, you're starting to have the scaling problem. That's a good one.
oh, I know.
Yeah.
And like so and I
That's what Biggie said, right?
yeah.
More money, more problems.
Basically. Yeah, and so I have one research assistant named Yash who's like helping me with doing research for newsletters, which like is super helpful. But yeah, I mean that's something I'm thinking about too. Like how do you even go about like hiring employees and like what people would I need to hire? What's the right number of people to yeah, it's just a classic like startup problem.
Yeah,
That I've like I think I've like covered a lot or I've covered somewhat as a writer, so it's interesting to like try to think through that firsthand now. I mean, hopefully it'll help me write about it better for sure, let
and if
alone actually do it.
you know a bunch of people who have had scaling problems, oh, so it's easy. You can also pick up your phone and
Yeah.
call a bunch of people pretty easily.
That's true.
You've seen the Icarus. You've seen the slow riser that actually end up working, like.
Yeah.
You can learn from that. Couple of like last questions to wrap up. While you're not a 60-year-old, 40 years of experience, you're actually wise beyond your age, and you've done quite a few things. We talked about timing. We've talked about doing things that are not in your comfort zone, like going in the fair, pushing your luck a little bit. You did maths. You did music, writing. If you like met yourself back when you were just out of high school, is there any advice you wish you had got? Is there anything that you did that you're like, this is the one advice I would give a 19-year-old? What's the thing, like, if you had one sentence with somebody who had a lot of potential, a lot of talent, trying to find themselves, what's the common thread there?
Yeah, I think So yeah, I mean the experience a lot of the experiences that I just like laid out in this interview definitely like inform my worldview in terms of so yeah, like one piece of advice that I would have that I in hindsight I was already doing but didn't know I was doing and like now very much proactively do now is like think about luck. Just think about this concept of luck in a very different way. Like a lot of people think that luck is something that they just have no control over. It's like, oh, I was lucky, so I got this. It wasn't because of like hard work or anything. But I think about it so differently now. Like luck is a mindset of just putting in the work and putting in the work around things that like you're truly passionate about. and truly enthusiastic about, and like truly follow your instinct in that sense, and like not pushing back on it. And then putting in that work and then just putting yourself out there, whether it's at a career fair or just like networking event or just any other kind of opportunity, just putting yourself out there and like getting yourself in the mindset of not being afraid to do that. That plus like putting in the work and kind of staying true to what you're truly passionate about, because that will produce the best work, I think. That's my opinion. That is what made me quote unquote lucky in like meeting this Forbes editor, for instance, right? But like I don't see that as luck. I just see it as a combination of a lot of timing, but just like realizing that I was like super enthusiastic about this area, doing a ton of research about it, doing a ton of writing about it, and then just like deciding to like put myself out there and like go explore what opportunities were at this fair. And speaking of which, I think this may be, I don't think this is too specific. I think writing is severely underrated as a tool to just like get your thoughts out there, to meet other people like on or offline in the context of just like finding career opportunities. So underrated. Like I think a lot of people are scared to get their thoughts out on the internet. They're like, oh, what if I look dumb? Or like, what if I look back on this and it's like, oh, that wasn't good. Like, there are people, I don't know if this is harsh, there are people who are probably like running full-time businesses doing writing that isn't as good as like as how well you could write. It's basically how I put it, right? There are people who are running full-time businesses just because they took the initiative to do it. And like that, they showed up, and that's like the prerequisite, right? So if you just keep holding yourself back, then you'll just never even get that chance in the first place. So whether it's writing or I know a lot of like artists who are super active on Instagram, and they're like posting just like doodles that don't have any commercial value. Like they're not making any money, they're not being commissioned to do it, but just like getting their ideas out there, and people who are searching for those ideas will find you. And like, that's like the perfect match in terms of finding like-minded people online. And like that's been super helpful for me in my career specifically. And I think just for anyone, don't underestimate the power of getting your ideas out there, even if it's like not completely polished. If anything, it's probably better if it's not totally polished, because people get, you know, a sense of who you truly are and what your ideas are without like being like going through some kind of filter. So yeah,
if you want to win the lottery, you have to play. If you want to end up being one of the top writers in your field, you got to start writing and just put yourself out there.
Also, yes, like most writers will say the best way to write is to do it, and I kind of learned that on the job. Yeah, like the only way to get better at writing, you can take all the classes you want. This is kind of like going back to jazz, right? Like you can take all the jazz theory classes you want, analyze all the like improvisation, your favorite improvisations, but that literally will do nothing for you in like actually getting better at improvising. And like writing is, I think, like very much the same thing.
Yeah, the best way to learn how to improvise jazz is to go and then improvise for 8 hours.
Improvise, yeah.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great way to wrap it up. We're back where we started at the improv and the jazz. So I'll put the crazy giant step diagram so people can know what we're talking about. Cool. Well, thanks for doing this. I'll see you in LA at the Music Tectonics conference in a month. And I'll put a link to the Water and Music. I encourage highly everybody to read your words. They always make me think, and I know they will to the rest of the people out there. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you as well.
This was fun. Speak soon.
Yeah. Yep, that's good.